Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Coach Ben Rosario Show. I am Coach Ben Rosario, and today I'm going to be talking with a guy who is, in my opinion, and really in anyone's opinion who has any common sense, one of the best high school cross-country coaches of all time, and that is Coach Dan Green. Dan coached at the Woodlands, Texas, for many, many years. He was his teams won 16 state titles in Texas, which is kind of just really mind-boggling. And I can't wait to ask Coach about how he was able to do that. I've seen Coach Green speak before. He made a huge impression on me, and I've kind of been a fan of his ever since. I was sort of a fan of his even before that, just from what all he had accomplished. But hearing him speak in person was really, really inspiring, and I hope it will be for you guys as well as we talk to him today. He currently coaches some post-collegiate athletes through Team Green Running, which is out of the Woodlands where he lives. And so I'm going to talk to him about that, as well as about his days at the Woodlands, how he was able to motivate his athletes to such excellence and such sustained excellence for so many years. You know, the book I'm working on, Tradition Class Pride, Building a Cross-Country Dynasty, is all about how to establish a program that will succeed for a long time. And that's about more than just the nuts and bolts. It's about being able to instill in the kids a tradition that will be passed on by them to their underclassmen. It's about instilling confidence. It's about instilling pride in that jersey that you wear. And you know, obviously the Woodlands, much like York High School in Illinois or Fayetteville Manlius in New York, or some of the you know, more famous high school programs, Meade High School in Washington, that's what they had at the Woodlands. And so it'll really be interesting to get a little bit of insight from Coach Green as to how he created that. Coach Green also has been a major influence on a ton of coaches, not just me. So it might be interesting if we have time to get to talk to him a little bit about just the coaching world in general and what it's like to coach young people and have such a huge impact on their lives, as we know he did through his years. I know some of his top athletes, you guys have probably heard of some of them, like Reed Connor, who ran at Wisconsin and was very successful, and many, many others. I'll let Coach Green kind of talk about his program and all the different things that they were able to accomplish there. He's supposed to be calling in any sec now, so let's just hope he does that here shortly. Let me see about this here. Okay. Hopefully he'll call in just a sec, and here he is. So without further ado, let's go to the guest line and talk to Coach Dan Green.
Hear me, Ben?
Yeah, I can hear you, Coach. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to talk to you.
Very good. I'm sorry?
I said it's good to be talking to you.
Oh, yeah, good to be talking to you, Coach. I was just spending the last couple of minutes trying my best to introduce you, but you have a lot of accolades, so I thought maybe we'd just kick things off with you kind of telling the listeners, you know, your history a little bit and how you got the job at the Woodlands, and then just, you know, maybe a brief history of what you were able to accomplish there, what your teams were able to accomplish.
Well, you know, it's really kind of crazy. I'm an accident. I came up from a small school in Pearland, Texas, just on the south side of Houston. It was very small, which gave me the opportunity to play football, basketball, and run track. My parents, neither of which completed high school. My mother went back to school in later life, you know, and got a teaching degree and taught for, forever, first grades in Pearland. And so I didn't have any sort of role models in sports or anything like that. And I remember going out for football. I didn't know how many people were on the team. And so, you know, I mean, it wasn't, in all fairness, too, it wasn't, you didn't have the television exposure and, you know, all that stuff back in the early 60s that you have today. You know, it's, you're completely saturated with sport today. But anyway, so I ran track, and I was reasonably successful there, you know, again, basically because we were small. We didn't have a track at our school. But, you know, I was sitting in a study hall, and my football coach was in there, and he was an All-American, Jim Davis. He was an All-American at OU, and he was a walk-on. He's a Native American. And okay. He just, you know, I said, Coach, he said, Dan, where are you going to school next year? And I said, I'm going to U of H. He said, you're going to run track? And I said, well, track coach doesn't think I'm fast enough, you know, to make the team there. He said, oh, bull. What are you doing next Saturday? I said, nothing. And he said, okay. So he goes down and he calls Coach Johnny Morris at the University of Houston, got an interview with him. I went in, and I became a walk-on. And to tell you the truth, you know, going to college, it gets pretty tough running and going to school. And there was a couple of times I didn't know if I was going to make it. But I remembered Coach Davis telling Coach Morris he bet him a steak dinner that I would make the varsity team before I graduated. And that, you know, little thing like that, it just stuck with me all the way through. And I was able to run there at U of H, and I earned a scholarship. And in the process of that, I came into the presence of just an awesome coach and a great person in Al Lawrence. Al's a bronze medalist in 56 in the 10,000. And he was a University of Houston ex and helped him win the, you know, national cross country championship in 1960. And in fact, I think it was maybe in the 2000s when somebody actually won USA track and NCAA track in the same year. Al Lawrence was either the last guy or the next to the last guy to have done that. And he's just an awesome athlete, but just a tremendous person. And he worked with myself, and I had a guy that came into U of H when I came in, Leonard Hilton. And Leonard and I became best friends. He was from Hillsboro, Texas. And, you know, we had a lot of foreign athletes on the team and a lot of athletes from New York and California and Canada. And Leonard and I were the only two distance guys. The freshman, and so we just kind of hooked a bond. Well, Al trained both of us at the U of H, and then when we left, you know, I was a 424 miler, you know, 152.280 guy, and you know, I didn't have any ambition to run later, but Leonard, you know, he was I think got third in the NCAA's 5000, and he was All-American as a freshman in cross country, and Leonard wanted to run the Galveston Marathon, and so he picked me to go on the team. We had to have a team of three. I remember the first distance race I ran was 15 miles. There was, you know, it was back in the old days. There was no water stops or anything like that. It was just out and back. I was so far ahead of third place, behind him, I couldn't see him. I was so far behind or ahead of fifth place, I couldn't see him either. So I ran through 6 miles. I PR'd at 6 miles, and I had just another 9 to go. And that was the worst run of my life. I remember getting through. I was sick at my stomach. I had diarrhea. I told Leonard, I'm not running a goddamn race over 800 meters anymore. That's it. I'm not doing that. But lo and behold, I did run it, and just off the story there, it was a Galveston Marathon, and we ran down the beach. We were on the sand. And, again, no aid stations, nothing. I see Leonard. He comes by, you know. I figure, he's already through. You know, I ran a whole 3:19. And Leonard's waving, keep it going. You're looking good. I get back, finish, go back to the hotel. Leonard didn't finish. He dropped out. I wanted to kill him, but I was too weak after the marathon to really do damage. But long story short, Al Lawrence started working with me. And I won the first Houston Marathon. I blazed a whole 2:32, but it was enough to win in those days. And you know, it's good enough to get me a free entry in there each year, which is really nice now to be able to go and not have to worry about lotteries and things. But anyway, I got out of school, and went to Pearland High School where I graduated, and I was just a math teacher because I was still running, and I hadn't really given a whole lot of thought to running. But the way the classes were configured there, I had an opportunity to – well, I had a conference period and a lunch period back-to-back, which gave me about 2 hours. So I would go and do one of my runs there. And by this time, I'm hooked into distance running. Al Lawrence has got me going, and Leonard, and we're training like wild men now. You know, I'm doing 100-mile weeks. I mean, I'm caught up in the world of distance running. And a head football coach saw me out there, and he asked me what I was doing, and I told him, and he said, look, he said, I'll give you $500 if you'll be an assistant track coach this year. Well, I was making $500 a month for teaching. So that was pretty huge. So I said, I'll do it. So first year was a hell of a learning experience for me, pretty humbling too at times, and because I wasn't much older than the kids I was training, and I darn sure didn't look as old as they were at times. And the second year I was there, I got a cross-country team going, and we got a new football coach in there. And the football coach said, called me in his office, and he said, hey, look, at this school, we're going to focus on football. So you can take a cross-country team to a meet after football season is completed. Well, football season can go all the way through December, you know, depending
yeah.
on how good you are. Well, fortunately, we didn't. So I got one meet with our guys, and then we got to go to district. Well, we didn't have a district. We just got to go straight to regionals because there weren't that much competition, you know, how many teams involved.
Sure.
So we got second in regionals, went to state, and got fourth. That was my first taste of cross country, and I fell in love with that stuff.
Yeah.
But I needed money. I had a son and married, had two boys, and I got an offer to go be a driver's ed supervisor, and I'd get a car with a job, and I had year round though. But I was making more money. So I took it. I resigned from Pearland. And by happenstance, a guy that was at Pearland, when I was there, went to Clear Lake High School as a football coach, and they desperately needed a coach, football coach, with a math teaching field. Because, you know, in Texas, you have to teach to coach. So they whined and dined me a little bit, and so I went. And I coached track and football the first year. And on the bus ride back from the district in Texas at that time, you had to be in the top two at district to advance to regionals, top two at regionals to advance to state, regardless of your time. And I had this little guy. His name is Dr. Jim Rollins. He's chair of the chemical engineering department at University of Wisconsin-Madison. He got third place, got nipped right at the wire in the mile. And we're on the bus ride home, and we're sitting there talking. He's a little emotional, and I'm a little emotional. So we get back to school, and we go out to the track, and we just jog around the track. So I told him, I said, I tell you what, Jim, if you will promise to train all summer with me, I won't coach football next year, and I'll coach cross country. And that was pretty brazen because they already had a cross country coach who was the head track coach, but I felt like he wouldn't mind if I did that, which he didn't. So I took a $2,000 pay cut, picked up an extra teaching class to coach cross country. And thank God my ex-wife was so sweet, and she didn't say anything about me doing that, because I was going to make $12,000 a year. When I took the two cut, I was only making 10 grand a year. So that was a huge commitment on my part, on her part.
Sure.
But I did, and we had success right off the bat. We were in the same district with Clear Creek High School, with the coach there is like a grandfather of cross country in Texas. And the first year I was there, he had a cerebral aneurysm and couldn't coach anymore. But I'm going to think of his name here in a minute, I'm sure, but. Just Max Blanchett was his name. And it was really tough because I really, I was a little arrogant. I wanted to coach against him. I wanted my teams to race his team because he was the mark in Texas. He had the teams. Lydiard based kind of stuff. Those guys run 110, 120 miles a week. And anyway, we beat those guys at district. No, they beat us at district. We beat them at regionals. And then went to the state meet the first year, and they scored, I think it was 89, and we scored 94, and Mac Allen scored 93. And, man, we were right there. We got a medal. And so the next year, I'd lost pretty much everything and built that team back up, and we went to state, and we were doing really well. Had some bad luck. One kid got sick and actually ran sick, but we got second in state. So I knew I was never going to be the head coach at Clear Lake. And the thing that kind of bothered me, I really loved the coach I was working with, but when we went to the state meet, on the packet that we picked up was just his name. I got no credit for coaching those guys. I did every practice. He literally drove the bus. He drove the bus to the meets. I did all the practices, I did everything, and I got no exposure for it. So I realized if I was gonna develop as a coach, if I was gonna get a head job somewhere, I was gonna have to move. So I interviewed in a couple of places, and I interviewed at Conroe Independent School District. The school was McCullough back then, and I interview, and I don't know. I didn't think the interview went really well. Went home, and so they called me back, and they said, could you come to the school on this date? And I said, well, sure. So my ex-wife was a teacher, so she took a sick day, and we went to the school, and we talked a little bit, and Bobby Wise was the principal then, and he said, well, if you get this job, I'm sure your wife's going to need a job. And I said, well, yeah. So he said, well, let's go talk to him. We'll send you to this elementary school to talk to this principal. So we did. So the principal said, yeah, I'll offer you a job today. I said, hold it. She can't take a job unless I get a job. He said, well, they haven't told you that you have a job. And I said, no. He said, well, I'm sure they will. And sure enough, they did. And, when I first came to this school, they thought I was crazy because I was talking about winning state championships because I still had a thirst for it because of getting second and third the previous years. But there was no cross country on this side of Houston, on the north side. There were people that had teams, but not good ones. All the good ones were on the south. But I had a short stick because I only had 9th and 10th graders the first year I coached here. But being impatient, which is a strong suit of mine, lack of patience, I didn't put my kids in the JV. We went varsity. And first chance I got, well, I put them in a JV meet, and we won it, and I'll be damned they didn't get any trophies out. So as soon as I got back home, I went to a trophy place, and I bought a big old trophy. Put it in a trophy case for the first one, because it's a brand-new school. It was the first time we had that. Well, I didn't realize, Ben, how lucky I was and the quality of the kids that I had, because I had a guy, in the second year there, I got a little wispy-looking freshman in there named Kyle Wright. Kyle Wright, he is a Foot Locker National qualifier. He is a 902 two-miler, 413 miler, two-time state cross-country champ. But we didn't win. We didn't win those first 2 years. And we didn't get the regional meet. We got fourth at district those first 2 years. And we had a famous meeting. That was back in the old days when coaches were not only allowed to, but they were kind of encouraged to be jerks, kind of like a sergeant kind of guy. So we had a little come-to-Jesus talk in the shed, and we didn't lose another cross-country meet until, that was 78. We didn't lose another one until, I think it was 88, we lost one. And we lost the only one by 1 point. But, we went on, and we 81, we won the state championship, and then we won it in 82. And our top guy was sick in 83, so we got second. And then we won 84, 85, 86, 87. And the 87 team was one of the top teams in the nation. We had Eric Henry, who ran 852, two, and we had Sean Barnes, who ran 9:13, and my son ran 9:12, and another kid ran 9:12, and I mean, we had some power in there, but I was young and ignorant, and now I'm old and ignorant, but I didn't realize, you know, every week we'd line up with a hammer. I mean, to tell you, we were just, well, we got to the point where people wouldn't ask us to come to cross-country meets because if we were coming, other teams wouldn't come. You know, we'd put a JV in there, unlimited number. If they were given 15 awards, we'd get 13, 14, sometimes even 15. We'd get all of them. And we'd 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the varsity. And a lot of times we'd go through 7. But, you know, we had some great teams in there. And in retrospect, when I look around the nation, you have this situation in every state where one or two schools are always going to be, you know, in the running for the championship. And then there'll be a couple of more kind of come in and go out. And as much as I would like to say the reason we won all that stuff was strictly because I was such a dadgum good coach and a handsome guy, the truth of the matter is it's a pretty good indictment against other coaches for not doing a good job, just between me and you in the fence post. And I see that. It really bothers me. And now that I'm retired and working with elite athletes, I work with high schoolers, you know, kind of on the side.
Yeah.
And when I look at what those kids do and the lack of commitment on the part of a coach, it just makes me angry. I just, 'cause these kids who run cross country, for the most part, they come out there wide-eyed and bushy-tailed, and, man, they're ready to do anything you want. And here in Texas, those kids are coming out in August. Coaches, about half of them, they won't do a thing with them in the summer, you know, because they want to be good guys. They want to give them the summer off. But these same good guys are going to take those kids after 2 weeks of training and going to put them in a race, and these kids are going to be competitive, and they're going to get out and run the crud out of themselves, and they're going to be sick or hurt, and all because, you know, coach was a good guy. We didn't have to practice this summer. You know, it's like, jeez, they kill so much talent on the vine, it's not even funny. And it's, I don't know, it aggravates me, but there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting point because, you know, truthfully, it's an interesting system in the U.S. because we're the only country in the world where your sports are, and your sports coaches are dictated by where you live and what district you're in. In the rest of the world, it's all club system in all sports, not just, you know, soccer or anything like some of the popular club systems are over here. And so, you know, if you're a serious kid and your parents are into it and you're into it, you know, you choose your coach. But here in the States, you know, you're bound to basically wherever you go to high school. And that's unfortunate because not everybody can have a Dan Green as their coach or Jim Linares, who was my old high school coach, who was fantastic, who I wrote a book with. You know, not everybody has that, and that is a bummer. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about, because what I'm trying to do here with this book I'm writing is to kind of put out a blueprint for young coaches who are coming into it and trying to show them, hey, you can build a dynasty just like Coach Green did or just like my coach did.
You just have to do
a few things, and you have to go a little bit above and beyond. And it is a full-time, you know, 12-month-a-year job. And so I was just going to ask you kind of some of the sort of things that you did, you know, outside, above and beyond just the nuts and bolts of the training that you think created that, you know, long-term sustained success, that tradition, that dynasty that was, you know, cross-country at the Woodlands.
Well, you know, it's interesting you said that. I just made a talk in Denver about year-round training. But, you know, before you even get to talking about training, I think as a coach, you have to be a role model. You know, if you're talking about Bill Ayers in Fayetteville Manulis, or if you're talking about the Koranics in Saratoga Springs, or, you know, wherever you go, if you talk about Justin Leonard at South Lake Carroll here in Texas, or my son, Jairus Green at the Woodlands, you know, it all starts with the coach. And, you know, if a coach doesn't like the program he's in, change it, because you have the power to do it. cross country is one of the few sports where training really, really makes a difference. You know, when I was in school, I was like, geez, maybe 4'11" in the ninth grade, weighed about 90 pounds. And I was in the weight room, you know, I was a football player, and the coach said, just keep lifting those weights, boy, you're going to be a great football player. Well, that was never going to be true, you know. It's a nice coach, but that was never going to be true because, you know, there are various measurements that I didn't have that were going to keep me from playing college football. And the same in basketball. But, you know, in cross country, Eric Henry was 6'4", 175 pounds, size 14 shoe. He's a state champion. Stacy Sutter was 5'6", 115 pounds, wore size 6. He was a state champion. You know, it's the heart of the athlete you're dealing with. And I think in order to motivate these kids to endure the minus 30 degree weather or the 90% humidity at 80 degrees in the morning, you have to set a model of, you know, commitment, sacrifice, and hard work. That was our three things all the way through the Woodlands. That's what we were all about, you know, and winning follows accomplishing those tasks. Now, I was at a level 5 IAAF school last January, and someone brought up the word sacrifice, and one of the coaches said, we don't like to use that. That's a negative term. But if you don't have sacrifice, how do you measure commitment? You know, mm-hmm. If you don't have sacrifice, mm-hmm. You don't have commitment. You have convenience. And that's where a lot of coaches mess up because it's convenience. In 33 years that I coached at the Woodlands High School, I never had one spring break. I never took one Christmas break. I was, you know, we were practicing every day that we could legally. In the summers, I was at school 5 days a week, every week of the summer, except for the 2 weeks in July that we had them, you know, our team, that was our vacation week, or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the practice is important, then it's important for the coach to be there. Because three things happen when you practice, one or three. They're either going to run too damn hard, they're not going to run hard enough, or they're going to do it just right. 66% of those things are not good. So as a coach, when you're there, you have the opportunity not only to monitor what they're doing and to jack them up, but you can also see how, you know, what kind of effort did they have to accomplish the goals that you gave them for that day. Were they running their guts out? Were they doing it easy? You know? So it all starts with a coach making the commitment, setting the example. You know, I never had one parent come to me and complain about the summers because, you know, we would tell the parents at the start of the year, look, you know, this is a year-round program. One time a parent said, Coach, do you allow youngsters to, I'm talking about cross-country group, do you allow youngsters to participate in other sports? I said, oh, yeah. I mean, we really want our athletes to be two-sport people. I see that smile on her face because I knew what she was thinking. She was thinking soccer. And I said, oh, yeah. Every one of our cross-country guys run track because track is off-season cross-country and cross-country is off-season track. And that's how we get it going. But I never had any parents complain simply because, you know, it wasn't a deal where their children were having to come in the summer and train and old coach was off in the Bahamas somewhere, you know. It's just – I mean, it's a hell of a commitment, but if you want to win, you can do it if you get there and you work with the kids. And you got to sell the kids on what you're doing, and there has to be some fun in there, you know?
Yeah.
I picked up a long time ago, you know, during the cross-country season, every second Tuesday, we would go bowling. I had a deal with a bowling alley, and you can probably still do that. They shouldn't have charged us for bowling, to be honest, man, because those guys probably ate $20 a piece of food while they were at that bowling alley, you know. So they charged us $5 for two games. And cross-country guys, they might be, you know, slow afoot compared to sprinters, But when it comes to bowling, those guys can knock out two games in 1:15 without any problem at all. Most of the time, they're up on that alley before that pin setter even gets up. And you had to get after them a couple of times for that. But what I would do when we go bowling is I'd try to put a freshman, a sophomore, a junior, and a senior all on one, you know, alley, you know, one lane. And then each time we would rotate. And we'd keep score. And after the season was over with, we'd go back and have a little tournament. And people would be handicapped by what their average was. Now, that worked for a while, but those kids are pretty dang smart. And they realized that if they just screwed around, then in the tournament when we were giving out trophies, you know, they were bowling 60s and 70s, but they were really 150, you know, 160 bowlers. You know, they could get a, they could, you know, put the shaft to everybody on the handicap. But I got wise to that, so I had to. You know, we had the off week, the other Tuesday, we would go, you know, over to a little park, which is across the street from the school. And we'd have the kids, one group would bring hot dogs, and one would bring buns, and one would bring drink, and one would bring condiments. And we would meet over there, and while they were jogging 3 or 4 miles, I'd get the charcoal going and get the wings going. By the time they got through with the run, they just come right over and to the park, and boom, we'd be feeding them hot dogs. And we played Bunco, which was it's a little dice game. Ladies generally play this game, but not with the fierceness as we played it. We had a lot of skint knuckles and, you know, a couple of bruised hands, because when you get that Bunco, you got to grab those dice. We were playing on a concrete floor there of the pavilion. And but the neat thing about Bunco, 4 people on a team, and after, you know, you complete one series, the winners of the group advance, and when they go to the next group, they rotate partners. So it's a constant change of people, so that everybody got to know everybody. You know, if we went on a summer trip, and they've outlawed those in Texas now, but we would take a week trip, and sometimes we'd go to Colorado. A couple of times we did, but I quit going to Colorado because the purpose of the trip was for bonding, but also to get them ready to run. And when we left Houston and we went to Colorado for a week, you know, when it's 70 degrees, no humidity, and tonight it's 40, and we come back home and the low is 80, I had to get them reacclimated to the dadgum heat. So, you know, kids here, they can all afford to take a vacation. So our purpose was for cross country. So I quit going to Colorado. We went to Arkansas. My older son was there. Been going up there a lot, so I had a good feel of the lay of the land. And so we would go up there for a week. And, you know, in the van ride, I would put certain kids in each one of the vans, and we'd stop for gas. We'd switch. We'd switch people out, you know, so that they had an opportunity. They were kind of forced to get to know their buddies. One of the more fun things, and I used to really get a kick out of it, because it would light up the dadgum internet, you know, once the computers got going. But we would have our annual red and green 2-mile run on the Friday night before the district cross country meet. And in Houston, October, you know, the middle of October, there's some awesome evenings. And, you know, I mean, Reed Connor ran 8:54, and his teammate, Drew Butler, was 9:01, their senior year in that thing. But I've had as many as 22 guys break 10 minutes in that run. And but, you know, it was a deal where I divided them up as evenly as possible. Every man scored, so it wasn't a 5-man team. If we had 45 guys or 46 guys on a team, it's a team of 23 against a team of 23. Red team, because our colors were red and green, there's a red team, they could only wear red. So generally our shorts were red, so they could wear the red shorts. Yeah. And the tops had green in it, so the green team would wear the top.
Yeah.
And well, after, you know, you know how kids are. First couple of times, they're just out there. The next, somebody's got some of that body paint, and he's got his hair all spruced up, and he's got part of it red and part of it white. And somebody, well, we had a little guy back in the, I think, 99, in 2000. He was a little freshman, and his mother was Asian. So he had the beautiful skin, you know?
Yeah.
And it was saving because he took red marks a lot, and he put circles around his eyes and circles around his arm. But unbeknownst to him, it was indelible.
Oh.
And for a week, thank God he was dark-skinned. If it had been like me, it looked like two red lights walking in the dead gym door, you know, because it would have really, really shown with my pale complexion. But, you know, we had some great times, and the kids had great fun doing it, and it's something that my son has kept in. But it's really pretty cool. But these kind of things that you can come up with are really big. Both my sons ran for me, and Danny graduated in 88. He's an assistant coach at the University of Arkansas. When he comes home, the first person he goes to see is Curtis McLemore, who was his teammate. My older
yeah.
son is the same way. I mean, these guys not only develop friendships that last through high school and college, I mean, these bonds go a lifetime. And it's really encouraging for me to know that these guys still care for each other. They still are concerned about each other. And, you know, a lot of it is just because of the bonding he had in the team.
Well, that was awesome. I knew that you'd, or I hoped that you would go into some of that stuff, because those are some of the stories that you told a couple of years ago when I saw you speak at a high school camp here in Flagstaff. And I believe that, I mean, more than anything, that's the kind of stuff that made your team great, and that's the kind of stuff that makes all the great teams great. It's the bonding, it's the care, it's the time and effort the coach puts in over the course of the entire year. And like you say, when the athletes see the coach putting in that much time, it's just human nature. It's just like when you have a good boss. You work harder for a good boss. You don't work as hard for a not so good boss. And I think that's what it is in a lot of cases. Now, when it does come to the nuts and bolts a little bit, I know that I remember you also talking about adapting things over the years. And you know, obviously you had it quite dialed in there for a number of years. Talk a little bit, at least, about just your basic approach to training at the high school level.
Well, you know, again, like I said, I was a very blessed guy. And I think it was 1985, I went to a level two, the second level two endurance school that USA Track put on. And by happenstance, I came to know and love just a probably the foremost distance coach in the United States, in Dr. Joe Behill.
Yep.
What an awesome man, and what a generous man he is. And I was in awe. Of course, I was also, my brain, I had a little bit of physiology background, but when I got through with his physiology, I was like, holy crap, I didn't know all that stuff was in there, you know? But we struck up a friendship, and he has been a sort of a mentor for me over the years. But, you know, I would say, too, an important thing for young coaches is to seek out successful coaches in your area, or go to clinics where the successful ones are and offer to buy them a Dr. Pepper or a beer or dinner, and just sit down and talk about track and field, because you can learn so much. Track coaches are not like football or basketball coaches. They are always willing, well, the good ones are always willing to share. And one little point I'd like to make too, Ben, people say,
yeah.
Well, you know, a great coach. Well, what's the criteria for a great coach? Well, a criteria for a great coach is the same as it is in any sport. Would you know Nick Saban if he hadn't won four national football titles, or however many he's won? No, winning is the difference between the great coaches and the other coaches. Now, people say, well, you know, my coach was in a place where we didn't have any athletes. Great coaches are like miners. They find those athletes. And I know you're in Flagstaff, so you've probably been to Alamosa, Colorado. But how in the hell did Joe Behill get people to come to Alamosa, Colorado? And, you know, the kids he got were you know, 440 and 430 and 450 kind of guys. and he developed those people. Great coaches have a way of winning. They'll find the way. And, you know, if you're not winning, just keep looking. You're going to find it. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to win a national championship every damn time, but it means you're going to have great teams, and your teams are going to win more than they lose, for sure, if you get out there and you hustle for these kids. But that is a critical thing for young coaches. Get out there and rub elbows, just like I did with these coaches. You know, I went to the Foot Locker National Championship with Kyle that first year. I told my ex-wife, I said, I'm going every year, because I sat in the bottom of the Hotel Del in a little pub they had there till like 3 o'clock in the morning, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night. And I wasn't getting drunk. I was there talking with guys like Ben Lanana, you know, Max Mayo. I was talking with all these coaches about, you know, the things that they do in their neck of the woods and how they get it done, you know? And the truth is,
that's still
we all
what it's
do
like.
It
that's
about
still what
the
it's
same.
Like in Foot Locker. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Yeah, it is. We just have different personalities, and we kind of do the concepts a little different. But the concepts are the same. And so the things that I learned, a couple of things that I've picked up on, is that your program can't be static. Now, you don't want to change just for change purpose, but you've got to stay current with the knowledge. You've got to stay right up at the cutting edge of the methodology of getting things done, because things aren't done today like they were done before, you know. And you've got to figure out the balance between work and rest. And so many times, young coaches, they go and they listen to these great coaches, and they come back and they want to put all these pieces into the puzzle, but the puzzle's not big enough. Yeah, I'll give you an example. I got a wonderful 800-meter runner. He just qualified this weekend for USA Indoor Nationals. And let me tell you, we went up there. We went to Arkansas to get in a great race, and the great race didn't materialize. The guy generally comes through in 50 to 51, came through in 56. James is 56.2. He's got to run 149.5. James bolted out of that thing, ran 53.2 for the last 800, won the race, ran 149.47, qualified for USA Nationals, you know. But James is a full-time worker. He works downtown Houston. He has a master's degree in taxation, and he's a tax accountant. And he literally drives from his office in the evenings when we have a workout to the track, changes clothes in his car, does his workout, goes home, gets home around 9 or 9.30, has dinner, goes to bed, and he's leaving the next morning at 6 or 6.30. Now, it would be nice to have him in a weight room somewhere or doing some sort of ancillary work. But to do that, I would have to take away from sleep.
Yeah.
He needs sleep more than he needs anything else. You know, it's all about specificity of exercise. And too many young coaches today want to try to find an easy way to get from point A to point B. There is no easy way. It's running.
Yeah.
You want to be a great runner? Run. Want to be a great pianist? Play the piano. Want to be a great swimmer? Swim. You don't see too many swimmers who are running, you know, to help them be better swimmers. But we got a lot of guys who want to get in the swimming pool to be a better runner. Now, hey, if you've got an injury and you have to get in the pool, fine. But the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. And the same is true in training for a specific event. It is do that event. And,
yep.
You know, too many times we have people want to Pilates it, they want to yoga it. Well, you know, at my age, Pilates and yoga and running, that's really good for fitness. But when you're talking about excellence through running, and that's what we're about at Team Green, we want to teach excellence through running. Well, shoot, that's running. That's what we got to do. So, you know, take your work, look at it, make sure it is specific to what you want. And balance, it is huge, that balance with rest. Because You know, physiologically, we know that the body doesn't build in the work phase. It builds in the rest phase. So when we tear it down, if we don't give it time to rest, and, you know, it's just by the grace of God, the way he put the human body together, that people aren't dead because our bodies adapt so well. But we've got people doing all kinds of crazy things. You know, and the bottom line is there is an optimal way to do it. Some people can do all that crud and survive, but the majority of people can't. They're either going to get sick, they're going to break down, or they're just going to get mentally jaded and say, sheesh, I can do something else. I want to do this. So that's an important aspect there, you know, is getting these things lined out so that the athlete is trained specifically for the goal. You know, if you're gonna try to run, and I've been guilty of this a lot of times. You know, of course, you're training some great guys, and you're doing a great job there in Flagstaff. And guys like you really make me feel good about the future of our sport, because so many people are getting into this. They don't have the appetite for the training or the sacrifice that they have to do to help young athletes, you know, achieve the next level. But it is a tough thing to get these guys rolling, and it's an expensive thing, I might add. It's kind of tough.
Well, for sure. Well, let me jump in and go ahead and give you a chance to talk a little bit about Team Green Running and exactly who you guys are, what you're doing, who you currently have on the roster, and just a little bit about that project.
Well, yeah, again, it's an accident. You know, Chris Hollis from Adidas, well, he's in Mizuno now, but overheard a conversation I was having at a Diamond League meet about coaching post-collegiates, and he asked me if I was serious, and I said yes. And so he hooked me up with Eric Osterhaus with Adidas.
Yep.
And so we got a little group started, and, you know, it's – And again, I know you know this, but most people don't. There are a lot of people out there that think they would like to train for the Olympics. They think they'd like to be an elite athlete. But when the hammer comes down, I'm telling you, there are not too many people around. We're training a group, and you know, I don't mean any disrespect to anyone, but our society has gotten to the point where it's all about finishing. And I think marathons and Ironmans and triathlons have created this culture of just finish. But the truth is, finishing a marathon, anyone can do that. The deal is, can you finish in a certain time? Can you push the limits on that and maintain your focus and energy so that you can finish that under 3 hours or under 4 hours? Or under 210. And so we got to combat that thing, too, because that's out there. But with us, we had about eight or so guys running last year for Team Green. And we have a pretty good little situation here. We have the support of Adidas, which is good for us. We have the support of Memorial Hermann, the Ironman labs that they have there. We have one here in the Woodlands. And, you know, they provide physiological testing for us, blood work for us, got a dietitian working with them. We've got a masseuse. We've got a strength coach. So, you know, we have a lot of amenities. We have trainers that through the Ironman that can work with these athletes. And we have several local doctors here that really, Dr. Lehman and Dr. Steve Clothier, that really help our kids, you know, one-on-one when we have a problem. So we have the setup for, you know, to do whatever we want to do. But I hired a team manager and a business person last November, a year ago, and she's did not have a big track background, but man, she is a really intelligent woman and has done a great job of learning. And she has a great mind. She's going to be a great coach. She's already done her level one. Her name is Elizabeth Webb. And so we were talking at Nationals last year. We had one guy there, half mile, James Gurley. and said, look, you know, we're not headed in the right direction the way we want to go. So when we came back, we had a refocus. We're training people for national competitions, you know, the half marathon championships, the USA 8K, you know, the club cross. These are things that we're about, getting to the nationals in indoors and outdoors. So that team sort of diminished pretty quick when the hammer, you know, when we started came back to turn the screw down a little bit, you know, because
sure,
the commitment level really gets up there. So we right now we're on a pretty good roll. We have six people working with us right now. Three are actual Olympic development types. Three are athletes that would like to get there, but they've got a lot of work to do before they can actually think about that. We got James Gilreath, who just qualified for his third consecutive indoor national championship, and he's been outdoors to the nationals the last 2 years. He's run 147.38 and 148.20 indoors. And last year in nine races, he was first or second in six of those, which we
nice.
Thought was pretty good. And then we have Jarrett LeBlanc, who came to us last year as a 408, 154 guy. And in the spring, he ran 150.7 and 401.3. And he had run 29:46 for 10K, and he has an appetite to run long. And so we worked him for he ran fast enough to qualify for USA Half Marathon Championships, and he ran 104.19, which was a huge PR for him, and he qualified for the trials marathon in
Very
LA.
Nice.
And we have a woman, Sam I get her name screwed up. I want to say McLean, but it's not. It's McClellan. Samantha McClellan. And she came to us from Western Michigan and off of 30 miles a week a year ago. She's had two really good races this year. We've been bumping her mileage up, you know, and she ran Chicago. And it's kind of tough here in Houston with the heat and the humidity in August that
sure.
you have to endure. But, you know, we've manipulated a few things, and she ran 248.22, which was a huge PR for her. But she came back in Houston and ran 115.34, just missed the qualifier by 35 seconds. Jared's going to help her at the Woodlands Half Marathon here at the end of the month. So, you know, out of our people, I feel confident that we'll have three athletes in the Olympic trials. And, you know, for what we have and what we're doing, I think that's a heck of a job for those athletes. I think they've done a marvelous job. But, you know, you can run long here if you do it right. We have great winters. So, you know, right now these guys can really ramp it up and have a good run. You know, we can run outside pretty much every day. It's not, you know, 45 here is not like 45 somewhere else. It's a little bit cooler due to the dampness, but you can get the job done, you know. And I think too many times athletes are looking for that utopia, you know.
Yeah.
I think the most important thing you got to do is just be willing to roll your sleeves up and work your ass off. That's, you know, that's the bottom
right.
line.
You
know,
that's right.
GPS,
that is the bottom line.
The heart monitors and all that stuff. Yeah. You think Emil Zatopek had any of that kind of stuff? But Diakila, he didn't have a pair of great shoes. He wouldn't have a boost. He was running barefooted. You know, it's just, as a coach, you know, I think oftentimes in our country, it's easier for coaches and athletes to be the victim. Oh, we don't have the same stuff that the OTC has. Oh, we don't have this and we don't have that. You know, the truth of the matter is, if we don't have it, don't be complaining about it. We don't have that kind of time. We've got to maintain all the sunshine, and because we don't have it, we're behind. Okay, let's work our ass off and let's quit worrying about it. And I think we
Oh, that's why you're the best coach. That's great.
well, you know, too many times I think we talk ourselves into a loss because we don't have it. I had a little kid at the Woodlands one time, and you know, Woodlands is a very affluent area, and you know, I don't mean to make fun of the women's, or I don't mean to make fun of poverty, but, you know, kid can't, I don't know if I'm going to do too good today. We didn't have any bagels this morning. I said, shut up and get on a bus, you knucklehead. I said, somewhere at this meet, there's a little Hispanic guy who's going to have eaten, you know, two burritos and a taco, and he's going to kick your tail all over the course. You know why? Because he don't give a damn about what he had for breakfast. All he cares about is kicking your butt. And that's too many times our athletes were soft because, you know, we got to do all this other stuff. No, you know, kind of like what's his name, the great marathon coach, God dang it, Coach Finlan. He coached the finish group, Lizzie Barron and those guys. From New Zealand. John Walker.
Lydiard?
Not John Walker.
Yeah.
But anyway, Arthur Lydiard, you know, I had an opportunity to sit by him one time at a track meet for 2 hours. And, you know, I said, what do you think about weightlifting? He said, I don't think anything about weightlifting. If you've got time to weightlift, you've got time to run. Get your butt out on the road and run.
Yeah.
And you know what? That's really true. You know, you'd like to make it, so that it's not that way because it's too cold where you are at times in the winter, or it's too hot here. But the bottom line is the tough ones are doing it. They're not looking for excuses.
Yeah.
They're looking for opportunities. And that's what we got to do. So for Team Green.
No,
go
ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. And we're hustling like heck to get a few athletes in here, and I think we got a couple that may be coming in at the end of the year, which I think are going to do really well. But, you know, we can't promise anybody anything but a lot of hard work, you know. I mean, it is butt-busting work. You know, we have amenities for athletes, and we take them, you know, we fly them to the meets, and we go first class. I mean, we don't fly up there on Saturday and run Saturday night. We fly up there on Thursday. We're there a day to acclimate. You know, we want to do everything we can for our athletes. We have one of the foremost sports psychologists, and Dr. Fran Parazzolo, that works with our kids. I mean, we've got some good amenities, but the bottom line is we got to do it on the track or on the road. That's where it happens.
Very good, very good. Well, Coach, this has been an awesome hour. I gotta get going because we're almost to the end of the hour. But I just wanted to thank you for coming on, and it was super cool. I'm gonna try to get it out there as much as I possibly can because people need to listen to you talk. You have great things to say, and hopefully, if people are listening, they were inspired.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate the opportunity. Have a great one.
All right.
Good luck to your
guys.
Thanks,
Coach. Thanks a lot. We'll see you around.
All right. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Oh, that was awesome. I hated to have to cut Coach off there at the end, but I could talk to him all day. But we're just about to the end of the hour, and that was absolutely, without a doubt, one of my favorite podcasts I've ever done. I say that a lot, but it really is true, and especially in this case because Coach is awesome. He had so many great quotes. I'm going to try to break this down and put some of those quotes out there because those are awesome. And, gosh, you just hear him talk, and you think, oh, wouldn't I have just loved to be coached by that guy? I was fortunate enough, of course, to have had some awesome coaches in my day, including Jim Linares, who was my high school coach. But you know, Dan, just the way he talks, and you could just picture him giving those motivational speeches to those high school kids and just having them so fired up for the races. But anyway, he's an awesome guy. So check out Team Green Running. Appreciate Dan coming on. Check out www.traditionclasspride.com for more info on the high school cross country coaching book that I'm writing. And we'll see you guys on the next podcast. Thanks a lot.